Good morning, everybody. It's great to be with you this morning, especially if you're a guest with us. We'd really like to welcome you. We hope that you find Crossbridge as a welcoming place. We hope that you're encouraged, that you're challenged, and if you're watching us online, welcome. You'll see things are in and out today. We're having some internet issues, so that's the fun of portable church sometimes, I guess. So if you happen to watch these online and you like to go back onto the Facebook page, watch them through, and it's not working, jump onto our podcast. It's all there too, and you can jump right in and stay with us through the conversation. But you know, this is a week I'm excited about. It's a week because we're starting a brand new series called Future Family, and I'm really, really excited about this series, and I want to be upfront with you about where we're going so that you know for the next 6 weeks what to expect. And this way, you can kind of set your expectations going, oh, okay, I'll avoid that one, you know, and I won't think about that. But at Crossbridge, it's very important for you to know that we don't necessarily think of each individual message. We look at the topics as a series. We look at them as a whole, and we have an idea of what do we really want to accomplish in this whole series, not just in this one message. And that's important for you to know because over the next 6 weeks, you may be challenged in some areas and you may be really encouraged in others, and it's designed that way, okay? We've designed this series that way, and this week is just an introduction. This week is an introduction to where we are going, and so you may leave this morning with some more questions than you do answers. If that's where you are, that's okay, all right? It's going to be okay. Next week, we're going to be diving into what I believe, whether you are someone who chooses to follow Jesus or you're someone who's exploring your faith, and I love that Crossbridge is filled with both. Crossbridge is filled with both, you know, those who are passionate about Jesus and those who are like, no, no. I promise you, next week, if you actually take and apply what we go over, it will change your life. It will change your family. I promise you. Week three, we're going to be diving into conflict. Does anybody have conflict in their family? Yeah. All right. So half of you are here and half of you are lying to me, and that's great. You're like, no, we don't have any conflict. This isn't a problem for us. All right. Well, you know, we have to talk about conflict when we talk about family because it's from the moment you wake up until the moment you go to sleep, there's some sort of conflict that's happening. You may not even need the other person. It's just with you. We're going to talk about how to deal with that. And I'm excited Will's going to do that, not me. So if you don't like it, you can yell at Will. Okay. Then on week four, we're going to talk a little bit about what do you do with the hard relationships in families, the ones that feel distant, the ones that you don't feel connected. And I know that even the words we use in family, mom, dad, brother, sister, they're emotional words. And for some of you, family is really, really messy. We're going to talk about how to deal with those relationships that are really hard. Week five, I am overly excited about and completely dreading at the same time because we're going to talk about parenting. This is the area that I feel like if we were to look at all of the things we're going to go through that I can't do this. And so I promise you lots of failure stories that week because I don't know how to do this. But I'm thankful for many of you who are good parents that I look to you and try to apply what you do. And if we could do this together, we'll be way better off. And then the last week, week six, we're going to talk about how do you leave a legacy? How do you plan in mind with your family now what your great-great-great-great-great-grandchildren might say about you? If they were to sum up and say they behaved or they did this, what would they say? And I'm excited Alan's going to be bringing that one for us and how to leave a legacy. Because it's so important for us. But here's the challenge that we're going to run into right up front, okay? Here's our challenge. All our families look different, right? Every family looks different. You're sitting here this morning, and maybe you come from that traditional nuclear family. Maybe you're in a second marriage, third marriage, in-between marriage. Maybe you're sitting here divorced, wondering, what do I do? Or you're sitting here thinking, I'd like to get married at some point. I'd like to have a family at some point. Can I tell you that if that's where you are this morning, I beg you, if you take the next 6 weeks and you apply it, your families will look so different. You might be able to avoid a majority of the mistakes we've already made, and that'll be so excellent for you. So if you're younger, and for our church at Crossbridge, recognize that we're like 60% 18 and under. Okay, 60%. So that means 18 and under that go to this high school, Clearview and younger, they're in there and a handful of you are scattered throughout here. That's a lot of kids. So we're all parenting, and we're parenting our kids, someone else's kids. We've adopted kids. We're fostering kids, dreaming. I mean, there's kids everywhere in here. So when we talk about family, we have to understand that it's so different for every single one of us, right? So what do we do with a series like this then? I think that's why it's so important, is because we're so different. And there's a pastor down in Georgia, his name's Andy Stanley, and he has done this series before. And I like the way that he sums up. He says there's two things that every family has in common. Every family has in common. And the first one is, when it comes to our family of origin, we didn't have a choice in the matter. Right? You could choose who your friends are, but when you're growing up, you can't choose your family. You can't choose that. And each one of us, maybe I'll make an assumption for you. Do you ever have those friends in middle school and high school that you wanted to be with their family, not your family? You went over their house because it's like they ate ice cream for dinner. They let you play video games and watch the movies you weren't allowed to at home. You want to stay up late? We don't care what time you stay up till. And you're like, oh, your parents are the best. I wish my parents were like that. Right? Anybody else besides me have those friends? And my parents were awesome, but I would have liked someone else's. Because you don't have a choice in your family. The second thing that we have in common is that we always think that no one that is related to us is as smart as we are. Right? No one that we are related to is as smart as we are. At some point, you have thought the phrase, if everybody would just listen and do what I tell them, it would be fine. It would be fine. We've all thought this, and maybe you're sitting here and you're in junior or senior high. You're in that 18 and under group now, and you're like, finally, Jimmy has said what I'm thinking. It must be right. It's not. If you gauge your right on what I say, you're in trouble. But listen, we all think this, don't we? We all think if they would just listen to what I say. And when you're young, we all think this. Your parents know nothing. Your grandparents know nothing. Your aunt and uncle, they're just crazy, but they're fun, but they don't know what they're doing. And something happens. As you get older, let me rephrase that. As you mature, I won't say get older because I think some of us get older and we still believe that. We haven't really matured. The more mature you get, the more you start to realize how little you know. Have you found yourself, maybe like me, you're driving in your car and you've just had that argument in your family and you're thinking, I should know how to do this. This has happened 100 times and I still can't do this. Why can't I ever do this right? Why don't I know what to do in this situation? We have those moments in our marriages, with our parents, with our kids, with our siblings. When it comes to our family of origin, we don't have a choice. We have that in common. And somehow when we're all young, we think if everyone would just listen to what I have to say, it would get better, until we start to mature and realize how little we know. The challenging part for us today will be managing that. What do we do with this? And it'd be great if we could just open up the Bible and say, let's look at an ideal family. Let's find the family that we can all model our families after. The problem with this is there's no good families in the Bible. There's not one family you can look at and go, oh, I want my family like that. And if you're going to be like, well, yeah, what about Jesus? Let me just tell you, if you have not left your kids somewhere for a couple days, you're already better than Jesus' family. His mom and dad went to a city, left him there, like, we should go home. Halfway home, they're like, where's Jesus? I don't know. A couple days later, they're like, oh, we should get him. If you're not there, you're already winning, okay? You're already winning if you've not left your kids somewhere. If you've wanted to leave your kids somewhere, it's different. Okay, but, I mean, maybe you go back to the beginning. What about Adam and Eve? Right, they have, everything's perfect, right? There's no issues that they have to deal with. And yet, we find Adam still chooses Eve over God. John Eldridge, in one of his books, he says, in the Garden of Eden, man chose woman over God. And men have been choosing woman over God ever since. You know, there's something to this. And even from the beginning, with Adam and Eve, family was messed up. The first homicide in Scripture, they're kids. You don't even have to get generations down the line till things get messed up. It's their kids. And when you start to unpack the Old Testament, it is story after story after story of the most dysfunctional, messed up families. If you want to be encouraged about your family, read about them. Because they are messed up. I mean, we're talking civil wars that happened in nations because a father and a son could not get along, or brothers couldn't get along, so nations split over family issues. Thousands upon thousands of people die because of issues that could have been resolved. But something happens when we get to the New Testament. Something transformational happens, and I wish I had the skill and the capability to communicate to you how big and drastic this change is. I don't feel equipped to do it, and I say that up front because it is so important that we understand there is a huge change. And what's going to happen is the Apostle Paul, he's this man who travels all over the world. He takes what Jesus says and all of Jesus' teachings, and he starts to try to introduce them into a culture where nothing like it has ever been heard. Nothing like what he says has ever been put into practice. From the dawn of time until the moment Paul starts to insert it into these cities. As a matter of fact, what Jesus says and what he taught about men, women, and children had never been part of this culture. Never. So when we look at what the New Testament has to say about family, I know that you're going to read some of this and you're going to be like, duh, this is easy. Jimmy, what you're saying is idiotic. I know that already. Or maybe you're going to look at it and think, Jimmy, that's archaic. My grandparents might say something like that. That doesn't work for today. We're looking at it with a 21st century lens. And what we need to understand is what Paul is about to communicate, what he's about to sum up about what Jesus said in the context of family had never, ever, ever been heard. It is revolutionary. It's life-changing. This would have floored everyone in this first century. And he's not just talking to a Jewish nation. He's talking to the Greek-thinking, Roman-behaving culture. And these ideas are new, especially his stance on women and children. Because in this culture, women held little more value than cattle. And children, sometimes children weren't even named because of the high mortality rate until they hit a certain point. They're like, okay, you're going to live, we'll give you a name. When Jesus goes and he's teaching to adults, and we have that story that we always like to look at when Jesus says, well, let the little children come to me. And when we read that, we're like, oh, that's so cute. He liked kids. That moment alone in Jesus' life was shocking to every man who was sitting there watching, because they would look and say, you're inviting kids into the place of adults? You teach adults. And when kids become adults, then they'll have value. When they can produce, when they can give, they'll have value. And Jesus is like, no, I'm bringing them in now. I'm taking what you think and I'm turning it upside down. They had never heard anything like this. You don't learn from children. And he says, no, if you look at the kingdom of heaven is like these children. Learn from them. That's not what they would do normally. And here's something you need to know. And if you don't believe me, you can go ahead and do your history research, and I'd encourage you to do this. But every culture since this point that has embraced a biblical worldview, a worldview that keeps men, women, and children on the same plane at the foot of the cross because of Jesus, every culture that has gravitated towards a biblical worldview, men, women, and children, especially women and children, have fared better. They have all received a different level of, I don't want to say civility. They're treated differently, not like cattle, not like slaves. They have purpose, they have value. And what I find amazing is that 2,000 years ago, Jesus knew and Paul helped communicate that we all have value, that we all have worth. And what's going to be so disconcerting for the men for women and children is going to bring an immense amount of hope. An immense amount of hope. So I know that you're going to look at these and be like, I get it. But please remember, this is revolutionary. Revolutionary. You ready for the quick sum up? Okay, you could talk back. You ready? You ready for a quick sum up? Okay, here we go. Let's start with Ephesians chapter 6, verses 1 and 2. I love this verse. It says this, children. Let's just stop there. Children, who's this aimed towards? Children. And who's a child in this room? Okay, if you didn't raise your hand, you've got a problem. You're like, you definitely were born, and that means you are a child and you have a parent. Okay, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with a promise. We should just end here as parents, right? Can we just pray and go home and make sure our kids get this, right? This is revolutionary. Children, obey your parents. Then we jump over to Colossians 3:18, and it says, wives, submit to your husbands, as is fitting to the Lord. And some of you may be sitting here thinking, whoa, 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 you don't know my husband. Just wait, because I'm not finished yet. In Colossians, it continues, husbands, love your wives, and do not be harsh with them. Now, why would Paul say this? Because men in that culture, they were harsh with their dogs, they were harsh with their slaves, they were harsh with their horses, they're harsh with their wives. Because they weren't that much more valuable. And Paul says, no, 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 no. Listen, those days are over. You need to treat your wives well. Do not be harsh with them. It matters how you treat them. You do not own them. You can't take advantage of them. You can't trade them like a Pokemon card. You're supposed to love your wife and not be harsh with her. It's important how you treat your wife. This was new. This elevated the status of women. And then a little later in Colossians, it says, fathers, do not embitter. And if you've grown up in church, you may have heard this a little different. The word exasperate, which is a little bit more powerful. But fathers, do not embitter or exasperate your children, or they will become discouraged. Now, I've already told you that this parenting thing is a struggle for me. It's hard. And when I look at this idea of embittering or exasperating your kids, it means that it's like when we're trying to discipline our kids. We're trying to do what's right. We say certain things with a good intention, but maybe for you like me, it comes out wrong. And it comes out and it makes them really frustrated, really ticked. And you may be sitting here thinking, but I was right. I don't care what they feel. I was right, they were wrong, and they needed to know this. I understand that, but we have to understand that our words have weight to them, don't they? Our words have weight. How we say things and what we say matters. And moms and ladies in the room, please understand, your words have weight to them. And if they had weight, they weigh like 25 pounds, and they sit on your kids. They sit on your spouse. But men, your words weigh like 500 pounds. What you say, it's not that it's more important. It just weighs more. I've asked families all over this morning at Crossbridge, do you think this is true? I don't want it to be offensive, but do you think it's true? And almost every family would look and say, oh yeah, yeah. I know it's true in our house. It's not what I say is more important than what Eileen has to say. But I know that when something needs to happen and Daddy says it, there's a little bit more standard attention. 2,000 years ago, Jesus knew dads. Men, your words carry something heavy to them. It doesn't say moms don't exasperate your kids. Who is this directed to? It's directed to fathers. It's directed to fathers. We need to be careful about how we speak to our children. There are so many examples in my life where my intentions were good, but my words were wrong. They were heavy. And my kids have come back, and I could see the dysfunction and part of their dysfunction in their life because of my words. Fathers, do not embitter, do not exasperate. Be careful of your words. do not treat your kids like they are a slave. Because you can do that with your slaves in that culture. He's saying, no, you need to look at your children differently. That's pretty much it. That's our summary. Here it is. And if you can't come back for the next couple of weeks, it's nice and easy. Husbands, love your wives and be considerate. Wives, submit to your husbands. Children, obey your parents. Fathers, don't irritate your children. Seems so simple, doesn't it? This is so simple. This is the ideal. This is God's plan. Isn't it funny, though, how ideal and real look very, very different? Ideal and real look so different for us. So it brings us to a tension that we have to manage, this issue that we're going to have to deal with. And this is the context that we're going to work within for the next 6 weeks, is we have a tension that we have to manage between what God sets up as the ideal and what we look at as real life. Because there's a huge gap. Wouldn't you agree? There's a huge gap between this ideal, and I can already tell some of you, especially some of the women in our church, because you are bold and you get things done, you're looking at that second one, you're like, mm-mm, I'm not waving any white flag. We're going to talk about that. It's important. No one's asking you to wave a white flag. Okay, no one's asking you to roll over and say, you know, husband, you win for everything. I can see it on your faces, so it's okay. I love that one of our men in the church looked at this morning and went, that's not fair. I got two. They got one. You guys, there's a whole lot more for us than there is for the ladies, okay? Because Jesus' goal in this culture, he's elevating women, he's elevating children, and this is raising the ideal, even though we have the real. And here's the thing that Jesus did over and over, okay? Jesus pointed to an ideal all the time. He always pointed to an ideal, and he said, the kingdom of heaven is like, and the kingdom of heaven is like, the kingdom of heaven is like, and he would say, this is what it would look like. But he always had grace as he was elevating what the ideal was. He had enough grace and compassion for those who constantly fell short. He was raising the bar even though he knew people would fall short. One of my favorite examples is when he raises the bar on adultery, right? Everybody in that Jewish culture knew what adultery was. It was you take your body and you commit adultery with someone else. You are with someone else. And Jesus says, I know that's what real is. But let me elevate the ideal. The ideal, and he does this in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 5. He says, if you even look at a woman lustfully, you've committed adultery. So he takes what's real and he's like, yeah, I know this is what you're thinking, but ideally, you're going to guard your heart. At this moment when Jesus says this, he basically made an adulterer out of every man and woman in that culture. And he made an adulteress out of every man and woman that would ever read this, right? What hope do we have to never look lustfully at someone else? Come on, Jesus, that's not a fair ideal. You're setting me up for failure. And Jesus says, I know, but my grace bridges this gap. You can attain this. This is ideal, but real is right here. You can't make this jump, but my grace is sufficient. My forgiveness is there. He didn't set it up for us to fail. He pointed and he talked towards an ideal, but he refused to condemn those who fell short of it. This is the dilemma. This is the tension. This is the paradox. But my favorite part is this is the gospel of Jesus. This is where we need Jesus, because we have these ideals, or God has these ideals, but we have real. Life is messy. Family gets hard. Jesus even addresses this. One of my favorite examples is, and I'm just going to go right after it because that's what we do at Crossbridge. We talk about awkward things because Jesus did. You know, Jesus talks about this ideal, but also real life when it comes to divorce. I know that when we do a series on family, when I say second, third, fourth marriages, this isn't like, oh, well, maybe some. There's a large portion of our community. This is reality. And so it's important to talk about it, but what does Jesus have to say about it? There's an amazing passage when you get a little later on in Scripture where in Matthew chapter 19, I love this. Starting in verse 3, there's a situation where it says, some Pharisees came to him to test him. And they asked him, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any and every reason? This is a group of professional teachers who know their scriptures, their Bible, and they're coming and saying, they're trying to put him in a funky place. And the word that's used is they used to test him about divorce. Can I just tell you, divorce was a reality in that culture too? It's not different than it is now. We can say, well, it's different because people weren't getting divorced as frequently then as they do now. Divorce has been prevalent in our history as humans forever. It's there. So they bring up this family subject of divorce, and it's unique in that culture because men, again, we're at a different level in that culture. Men had the opportunity to divorce their wife for any and every reason. It was like no clause divorce. They didn't have to have a reason. You could just not like your wife and be like, I want a divorce. You could say, you don't measure up to her. She's cute. I want her. I want a divorce. I'll take her. This was reality. Why? Because women, you had no rights. If you want a divorce, guess what happened? Nothing. You're stuck. Is this fair? Is this ideal? No. And so I love the Pharisees that they're trying to get Jesus to validate their real, right? To say the real is okay. So the Pharisees are trying to trick him. And listen to what Jesus says in verse 4. He says, haven't you read, he replied. This is great. Haven't you read? That's the most insulting thing you could say to a teacher. Like, duh, don't you know this? Should I know this? Haven't you read, he replied, that at the beginning, the Creator made them male and female. This is a big moment because the Pharisees are pointing out that families aren't getting along. Divorce is part of their community. They're looking at reality. And what Jesus does is he starts with these three words. What are they? At the beginning. Jesus goes back to an ideal. He says, let's not talk about right now. Let's not talk about reality. Let's talk about the ideal. And the ideal is at the beginning, what did God do? He created them male and female. Because this ideal is going to conflict with what's real at the time. There's the tension, but Jesus is comfortable with this tension of here's the ideal, here's the real, let's just make it even bigger. Verses 5 and 6. And then he said, for this reason, man will leave his father and mother and will be united to his wife, and the two will become, what's that? One flesh. The two will become one. The two will become one. So they are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, let no one separate. Jesus takes them right back to ideal. It's not about preference, which is their real, right? The ideal is it's about unity. It's about oneness. God has an original plan, and no one, because they bring up Moses, right? You don't know. They're going to bring him up in a second. Moses says we can. He says, no, this isn't about what you think you can get away with. God has an ideal for you. And he's setting this high standard. So what do they want to do? What do they do with this tension of a bigger ideal but a hard reality where they are? They question him more. Why then, they asked, did Moses command that a man give his wife a certificate of divorce and send her away? They're pushing back on Jesus here, okay? They're trying to make him feel pressure. And Jesus replied, Moses permitted you to divorce your wives because your hearts were hard. But it was not this way from the beginning. That is a rough conversation, isn't it? It's even awkward bringing this up in this culture, knowing I bring up divorce and I could see people squirming a little bit. God has an ideal for our life. This ideal is that divorce is not part of it. But reality is, divorce happens. Divorce is difficult. And I've not met one person in my entire life who has ever been through a divorce that would stop and say, I really hope that my kids go through this pain. I really hope that they suffer like I've suffered through this. Not one parent have I ever met who've said, I hope this for my child. You see, God has an ideal, but we still have to deal with reality. And so then it makes us ask the question, so what does God do then? Does he set up the ideal and say, deal with a crappy marriage or get divorced? Like, what is it? Which one do I do? And Jesus says, yes, I love you right where you're at. I have an ideal for you, but I love you here. And so, yes, some marriages, Jesus even talks about later, should be ending. There are grounds for divorce. So does that mean God hates someone who gets divorced because his ideal is here? No. Because Jesus didn't come to condemn. He says, I'm going to bridge that gap for you. I have an ideal. We're going to reset here, okay? We're going to start over, and we're going to go for the ideal. We're going to go for the ideal, and I wonder how many couples that have been divorced would dream, you know what, maybe if things were different in the beginning and I knew what I knew now, it could have worked. Maybe it couldn't. Either way, Jesus doesn't look and say, shame, I condemn you. You fell short of the ideal. He looks and says, I recognize you're real. I recognize that there's a tension between here and what you want. And maybe you're on your second marriage, and it's like here. You're so close to this ideal. God is excited about that. He's not angry with you. He's not frustrated with you. And I know church sometimes can harp on people who get divorced. I get that, and I am sorry for that, because that is not God's ideal. God's ideal is oneness and unity. You know the pain. You don't need someone to deepen it for you. You need Jesus to meet you where you're at. Say, I have an ideal. I dream of better for you, for your second marriage. For those of us in the context right now who've, you're in a marriage that's hard. Maybe you're ready to throw the towel in. Jesus has given grounds for divorce, but he says, in the beginning, don't you know God's designed it for one, for unity? It's worth fighting for right now. It's worth going after the ideal, because where we're going to end together is this. We're going to be given a choice. As we dive into conflict, estranged relationships, parenting, leaving a legacy, all of these ideas, these ideals that Jesus is going to set, you have a choice, just like I do, to either say, God, I'm going to go after the ideal, or we can stop and settle. We can stop and say, God, reality right now, it's okay. And we can lie to ourselves, we can trick ourselves, and we can fool ourselves to say where we're at right now is totally fine. I don't get to make that decision for you. I only get to make that decision for me. And when I think about Crossbridge, I dream of a place where we'll trust the grace and mercy of God to bridge that gap between what's real and what's ideal. I dream of being a place where when there's marital issues and there's parenting issues and there's all that stuff that boils up that makes family so hard, there's a place that says it's worth fighting for. One of the values at Crossbridge is that we are family focused. Your family is worth fighting for, and that's why we're doing these 6 weeks, is because we believe as a church that God has an ideal. And for those of you younger that are not married yet, oh my God, will you let them get it? Would you just understand this will totally change your families? Go after God's ideal. It is so worth it. It is so worth it. It is so worth it. And if you're sitting here thinking, I don't have the energy to get there anymore, you do, and it's by the people around you. We will help you. We will fight with you. We will walk with you. It is worth it. It is worth it. It is worth it. Don't believe the lie that where you are now is going to be okay. It will be hard, but it'll be worth it. God's ideal is the best for us. And if he's got an ideal and this is real, we can trust Jesus to bridge the gap. That's all we've got. And so for the next 5 weeks, we're going after this. Will it be hard and a little murky? You betcha. But that's Crossbridge. This is what it's worth going after. Join me in it. Let's go after the ideal. Over the next 6 weeks, I am going to ask one thing from you. If you know someone, as you know now, the 6 weeks that we're going over, the five more weeks, you know the topics. If you know someone who's in a family who needs to talk about conflict, needs to think about parenting, needs to think about whatever it is, fill the seat next to you with them. There's some space for you. Every one of these topics that we talk about, whether someone is pursuing Jesus or not, it will make complete sense to them. They will understand it, and they will be able to apply something to their life that might change their family. And what a privilege it would be to be part of helping change families for the better towards an ideal. So I want to encourage you, don't come alone. Bring someone with you. If you miss it, follow it up online or the podcast, because we'll continue to build on this series. Amen? Amen. Will you pray with me as we close our service this morning? God, behind me, I hear chaos. And I completely recognize this is what each one of our houses looks like every day. I know full well that there is major marriage tension. I know that for those who are parents in here, it's hard. Even this morning, getting here was just difficult. I'm thankful that 2,000 years ago, you did something that changed everything. When you started to elevate the status of women and children, you said they're worth being at the same place as men at the foot of the cross. I thank you that we live in a culture where women and children have rights. God, I pray for even those areas around the world where women are not valued, where children are pushed aside and sold and traded. God, I pray that you would somehow allow your values of how everyone made in your image is worthy of attention and value, that they would somehow find that, that they would realize 2,000 years ago you changed the game when it comes to family and relationships. And I pray that right now in South Jersey, in this area, that you would allow us as a family and as a church here to build into families around this community. I think of so many I know that are wrestling, that are not doing well. God, I pray that over the next couple of weeks, you would allow us to embrace your ideal, not lie to ourselves and say we're fine, but look at the areas in which we can really better our family. And doing so, we see generation after generation. I dream of great-grandkids, of the families represented here, who say, my great-grandmother, my great-grandfather changed our family when they made these decisions. And we would see healthy marriages and healthy families years and years down the road. God, I thank you for this place. I thank you for our time together. And I pray that you would give us eyes to see your ideal this week. And when we fall short of that, we'd confess it and recognize you bridge the gap and you continue to call us to better for the sake of those around us. God, thank you so much for today. We love you, and it's in your name we pray. Amen.